Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. Whoo, these are trying times. And the BBC is reporting fraudsters have stolen 22 tons of high-value cheddar. This is not a drill, folks.
Wait, and that's not a euphemism like cheddar meaning money. That's just actual cheddar.
Literal wheels of cheese,
nice.
People. And this is a huge amount. And from local artisans. And so the sting is especially pokey. The actual figure, according to the BBC, is hundreds of truckles.
What?
Of cheddar. I will look that up later. But it was worth more than 300,000 pounds, which is close to half a mil US.
Yeah.
About that amount was stolen from London cheese specialists Neil's Yard Dairy.
So I looked up what a truckle was.
Oh.
It's just a cylindrical wheel of cheese.
That's not a useful measurement. What are they? What?
No, but a good word for it's not just a wheel of cheese. It's a truckle.
I mean,
what a delightful word.
I think all it's making me do is need a truckle of cheese is what's happening.
I hope that's giving you a good chuckle. Okay.
All right.
So over 22 tons is what that amounted to. And these were artisan cheddars of three varieties in particular. We had Halfod Welsh, Westcombe, and Pitchfork. They even took the pitchfork, you guys. So Patrick Holden, who owns the farm where the Halfod cheddar is made, said the artisan cheese world is a place where trust is deeply embedded in all transactions. It's a world where one's word is one's bond. Now, it might have caused the company a setback, but the degree of trust that exists within our small industry as a whole is due in no small part to the ethos of Neil's Yard Dairy's founders. Oh my gosh. That's like Ruth's Chris's Steakhouse.
Right.
The apostrophes in that sentence were all over the place. Now, Tom Calver from Westcombe Dairy said that the process of making that cheese started about 3 years ago when we planted seed for the animals' feed. Like, this is a whole seasonal process, right? The amount of work that's gone into nurturing the cows, emphasizing best farming practices, and transforming the milk one batch at a time to produce the best possible cheese, it's beyond estimation.
I mean, the thing that I don't understand is it sounds like these are such artisanal cheeses. How is anybody going to buy Pitchfork cheddar in the next year and not know that it was stolen?
Right.
Like, they're going to have to relabel it.
Right. Was there one cheese manufacturer that didn't have their stuff stolen so they can sell it?
Wipe out the competitors one truckle at a time.
Right.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from The Conversation. It's titled, Deep Sea Rocks Suggest Oxygen Can Be Made Without Photosynthesis, Deepening the Mystery of Life.
Ooh. Sounds cool.
Yeah. So oxygen, the molecule that supports intelligent life as we know it, is largely made by plants. Yeah, I was like, immediately.
Human bias.
Know, it's a stretch, but sure. Whether underwater or on land, they do this by photosynthesizing carbon dioxide. However, a recent study suggests that oxygen may be produced without the need for life at depths where light cannot reach. The authors of a recent publication in Nature Geoscience were collecting samples from deep ocean sediments to determine the rate of oxygen consumption at the seafloor through things like organisms or sediments that can react with oxygen. But in several of their experiments, they actually found oxygen was increasing as opposed to decreasing as they would have expected. They found that this, quote, dark oxygen production at the seafloor seems to only happen in the presence of mineral concentrates called polymetallic nodules and deposits of metals called metalliferous sediments. So the authors think the nodules have the right mixture of metals and are densely packed enough for an electrical current to pass through for electrolysis, creating enough energy to separate the hydrogen and oxygen from water. The authors also suggested that the amount of oxygen created may fluctuate depending on the number and mixture of nodules on the ocean floor. This research team was trying to understand the implications of mining metals from the deep sea floor, such as lithium, cobalt, or copper, funded by an extractions company in an effort to ensure deep sea mining leads to a net benefit to humanity and the Earth system.
Right, because if we take all of the metal out of the ocean, maybe we're getting less oxygen for ourselves and didn't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Appreciate the effort to look at all sides and not just the profit angle. Good job.
Yeah, props.
Right, and also for me, the probability of life on other planets under oceans is now even more exponential.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it feels like we're just finding water everywhere now. Like, there was another article that I did not cover, mostly because it was too many butt jokes. It was about your
I feel really deprived now.
Well, you can go find it. It's okay.
Yeah.
I'll giggle by myself.
It was mostly just like, hey, we found more water in objects surrounding Uranus, and that's the entire bit. So, you know.
Right.
But yeah, like we found ice on Mars. So yeah, it seems like life could have been out there, if not right now in the permafrost. But anyways, next link.
Next link.
All right. So I have some bad news, everybody.
No.
This is from FizzOrg. Typing monkey would be unable to produce Hamlet within the lifetime of the universe.
Well, yeah, with that attitude.
Damn.
I mean, wait, come on.
Wait, isn't that good news?
Well, I guess. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, if you hate Shakespeare and monkeys.
No, I love monkeys. I want to save them the effort of trying to come up with or at least replicate Hamlet. Do something else with your time. Have a banana, whatever.
Fair. I never thought about it that way.
So while the infinite monkey theorem is true, it's also somewhat misleading. And if you're unaware of the infinite monkey theorem, it states that a monkey randomly pressing keys on a typewriter for an infinite amount of time would eventually type out the complete works of Shakespeare purely by chance.
I mean, I guess I'd always heard that it was an infinite number of monkeys with an infinite number of typewriters. But actually, now that I'm thinking about it, the whole nature of infinity is one monkey is sufficient if time is infinite.
Would be enough.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's been used to help us understand the principles of probability and randomness and how just chance can lead to unexpected outcomes. The idea has been referenced in plenty of pop culture, from The Simpsons to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and apparently on TikTok. However, a new study reveals it would take an unbelievably huge amount of time, far longer than the lifespan of the universe, for a typing monkey to randomly produce Shakespeare. Associate Professor Stephen Woodcock and Jay Folletta from the University of Technology, Sydney, decided to examine the theorem using the limits of our finite universe. According to Professor Woodcock, the infinite monkey theorem only considers either an infinite number of monkeys or an infinite time period of what they call monkey labor.
Oh, see? That's what I'm sensitive to. Oof.
They looked at the probability of a given string of letters being typed by a finite number of monkeys within a finite time period consistent with the estimates for the lifespan of our universe. A serious but lighthearted study has just been published in the peer-reviewed journal Franklin Open. As well as a single monkey, they also did the calculations using current global population of around 200,000 chimpanzees, and they assumed a rather productive typing speed of one key every second until the end of the universe in around 10 to the 100th power years. The result revealed that it is possible, around a 5% chance for a single chimp to type the word bananas in its own lifetime. So that's something it can be proud of, I suppose. However, even with all the chimps enlisted, Hamlet, with around 884,000 words, will almost certainly never be typed before the end of the universe.
See, okay, so here's my problem with this entire analogy, and has been for years. If you take into account the real-world environment, a finite number of monkeys did, in fact, evolve to the point that they made a man named Shakespeare, and he wrote the entire works of Shakespeare, and they only took like 100,000 years to do it.
But are they still monkeys?
Well, who cares? You put the monkeys in the room,
care, which is why we
state.
Keep asking this question, because we keep feeling the need to assert ourselves over chimpanzees. But you said in the article, there are 200,000 of them left in the world globally. Yeah. We don't got to prove nothing. We won. Good for us. Enjoy Shakespeare. Let him not type, you know?
Yeah, I don't think we were trying to. I think it was just more of a theoretical.
Yeah, well, it's like that similar one I've heard where it's like if you put all the parts to a watch in a dryer and just turn it on, eventually they'll accidentally assemble a watch. Oh, and it's like, well, sure, but you're not taking gravity into account, and all these parts are going to get destroyed before that could theoretically happen. And, you know, it's all philosophy, which in my opinion is a waste of time.
Hey, now,
make dinner.
Hold on.
Shots fired, Angie. How are you going to do that?
I'm going to keep looking for a job.
So they do try to end this article by connecting it with the idea of AI and creativity and meaning. But it sounds like these guys are just the ultimate party poopers. Like, I feel like maybe the paper should have just been called, like, well, actually.
Right. That should be a new journal. There should be a scientific journal called Well, Actually.
Isn't that what Twitter turned into?
Yeah, you're right. That's free. Why would anybody pay?
Hey!
All right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, this next one is just delightful in every way. It's from Vice.com, and it's about a botched Andy Warhol art heist. So, you know, hopefully you already know the name, but just in case, Andy Warhol is the guy who did the Campbell soup picture. And more relevantly here, Warhol pioneered a particular aesthetic where he would print a single person's portrait several times in a row using different color combinations in each one. And he's got, you know, tons of these series, but one of them is called Reigning Queens, which features Queen Elizabeth II of the UK, Queen Margrethe II of Denmark, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, and Ntombi Tufuala, the Queen Mother of Eswatini, which is the modern name of the country formerly known as Swaziland. So, with four queens and four color combinations for each one, the work as a whole is an arrangement of 16 rather large portraits. But it's often displayed and sold in smaller portions. In this case, there were just four portraits, one of each queen, on display at the MPV Gallery in Oosterwijk, Netherlands, in anticipation of an auction later this month. And just a few nights ago, on Halloween actually, a group of art thieves tried to steal them. But they clearly had not thought through their plan very well, starting with the fact that their break-in was not subtle. They didn't try to pick the locks or circumvent the security system. They just exploded the front doors off, causing major damage to both the gallery and neighboring buildings and immediately drawing attention to themselves.
But it works in Guy Ritchie movies. Why wouldn't it work in real life?
Yeah, well, and it's like they haven't talked to the guys, so maybe this was their plan all along, but it feels kind of like they didn't judge the size of the explosion well enough, because like it was big enough. I'm pretty sure it damaged some of the art inside the gallery as well. Like they didn't know what they were doing explosives wise. But realizing now that they wouldn't have a lot of time, the group of thieves grabbed the four portraits and headed back to the getaway car, at which point they discovered that they couldn't fit more than two of the portraits in the car.
Okay, not a Guy Ritchie movie, a Mr. Bean movie.
There you go. Yeah.
It's an Econobox. Yeah, it's a Geo Metro with better features.
Exactly. So they ultimately abandoned the now damaged copies of Queen Beatrix and Queen Ntombi in the street, driving away with just Queen Elizabeth and Queen Margrethe. So, you know, standard post-heist police work. They're canvassing for witnesses. Forensic experts are assessing the gallery for clues. Given how bad they were at the first half of all this, I'm pretty sure they're going to catch the guys. But here's the real kicker. Those four pictures, of which they now have two, are not originals. They were prints. As are most of Warhol's pictures, because his entire medium is screen printing. When the series was originally released in 1985, Warhol did actually create a special royal edition that had a mix of diamond dust and ground up glass applied to the surface so they'd be sparkly and could therefore be viewed as sort of more original than the rest of the copies. And some of those do actually reside in Buckingham Palace, specifically ones that feature Queen Elizabeth II. They don't care about the rest of them. But even then, there are 30 full sets of the royal edition portraits, and these aren't even those. According to the author of this article, quote, "They likely have some value, but the thieves might as well have jacked a 500-piece puzzle of the Mona Lisa." So,
brutal.
Yeah, crime doesn't pay, I guess, is the summation here. I'm just like, how do you not measure the portraits and your car and have a good idea of where you're going to put them when you get out of there? Because also, it's clear like they weren't in the trunk or anything. They were like going across the back seat. So you're driving down the road with the evidence right there, visible.
Right. Holding onto it on the roof like it's a mattress.
There you go. They could have done. See, now you would be a much better art heist criminal.
Definitely. But that's a different life. And we're not talking about that.
Keep that down on the down low. Next link.
Next link.
Oh, goodness. From The Guardian. Alcohol consumption is abundant in the natural world, according to a new study.
Okay.
Like fish or
what? Like a range of species. Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know why fish is the first thing that came to mind, but I was just like,
they seem like the least likely to get drunk through a liquid. I get it.
It might be a little hard for them, but sorry.
Yeah, I think this mostly focuses on terrestrial for that very reason, because of how fermentation has to occur. I wonder if there's some deep sea kaiju sauerkraut fermentation situation going on. I'm sure of it. We'll find out about it later.
Well, yeah, fully aside from that, we've had stories before on the fish are all full of meth because we're putting it in the water supply. Yeah. If we pour some alcohol into the ocean, the fish are going to get a little drunk, I think.
You're welcome, fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, have some more Prozac, fish. Okay, so specifically, we're looking at fermented fruits, sap, and nectar producing ethanol in diets across a wide range of species. We, as humans, may have turned drinking into something of an art form or bacchanalian destruction, but when it comes to animals putting alcohol away, we're not such an outlier. A review of published evidence shows that alcohol occurs naturally in nearly every ecosystem.
Hmm.
Now, many creatures have evolved to tolerate a tipple and gain little more than calories from consumption, but some species have learned to protect themselves with alcohol. And others seem even less able to handle its effects when they encounter them. So we're effectively, with this information, moving away from this anthropocentric view that alcohol is used just by us, and that actually ethanol is quite abundant in the natural world. So it became plentiful on Earth about 100 million years ago, when flowering plants began to produce sugary fruits and nectar that yeast could ferment. Now, the alcohol content of this is typically low, like 1-2% alcohol by volume, or ABV. But in overripe palm fruit, man, you can get a concentration of up to 10% ABV, which is high even for us, right?
Hmm.
They did one study with wild chimpanzees in southeastern Guinea. They were caught on camera binging on the alcoholic sap of raffia palms. Meanwhile, spider monkeys on Barrow, Colorado Island, Panama are partial to ethanol-laden yellow mambem fruit, revealed to contain between 1 and 2.5% alcohol. But whether consumption leads to drunkenness, that's another question. Even though we've probably all heard stories of inebriated animals, from elephants and baboons drunk on marula fruit in Botswana to maybe a moose found with its head stuck in a tree in Sweden after eating fermented apples. Y'all seen that?
Yeah, I was pretty sure I saw a drunk squirrel on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah, we've seen them, right? But in none of these cases was alcohol measured in the animals or the fruit. So many animals seem to have an impressive alcohol tolerance. For example, despite the, quote, prodigious ethanol consumption of pen-tailed tree shrews, the scientists found no evidence that the animals actually got intoxicated.
Huh.
They concede it was unclear how an inebriated tree shrew would behave. So it's more like, you know, that friend of yours, when they do get drunk, like, you see no difference at all, but they're absolutely tanked. Maybe that's just how the tree shrew gets drunk.
Yeah.
Right? And there is some science to that, because animals that regularly eat fermented foods, they tend to metabolize alcohol rapidly. So that spares them the worst of the intoxicant effects. But some creatures, yeah, they encounter ethanol less often, which means they can be hypersensitive to the effects. For example, tests on cedar waxwings, which sadly died from crashing into fences and other structures, found that they were actually flying under the influence after gorging themselves on overripe berries from a Brazilian pepper tree. So here's a good quote from one of the researchers. Inebriation is not beneficial in an environment where you are fighting to survive. True facts.
Fair enough.
But perhaps the most striking effects of alcohol are seen in insects, believe it or not. Male fruit flies will actually turn to alcohol when they are rejected as a mate, whereas females... And
this is
no wonder
sad.
We study them. They are like us.
They really are like us. Now, even females of a closely related fruit fly species, they become less picky about their mates and have sex with more males after imbibing. Honestly triggered, just really triggered after that one. But in part, that's how fruit flies have adapted to lay their eggs in ethanol-rich foods. This protects them from parasites. This is where the protection thing comes in. So Earlier this month, the researchers that were led at Tel Aviv University, they found oriental hornets may be the only animals capable of consuming an unlimited amount of alcohol without suffering ill effects. These are those, Asian murder hornets? They're like the Hell's Angels. They can just get super drunk and they're like, yep, we good.
Just makes them angrier.
Oh, well, I mean, it's what fuels them. It's like Bender, right? They can ingest up to 80% ethanol solution without any negative effects on their mortality or behavior.
That's like, just their blood at that point.
They're just self-preserving. Absolutely crazy. So aside from the fruit fly and the slow loris, it's unclear if animals prefer ethanol-containing food. But the next step, according to researchers, is the test whether animals in the wild prefer ethanol-containing food or eat it only when the ethanol levels are too low to detect or unfermented fruit is hard to find. So it sounds like y'all won't get drunk.
Yeah, getting some animals drunk.
I hope they find their funding.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure someone will.
Right, they may have a thing towards it because the ethanol may kill some bacteria that makes that more pleasing for their stomach or something
like that. Well, and in the Civil War, we're sitting there pouring whiskey on open wounds because we know it sterilizes things. So, you know, they're at the Civil War stage of their development. And pretty soon, they'll be at the celebrity animals endorsing gins. And then it'll be,
So dark.
Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
So do any of y'all play incremental games or clicker games?
Oh, no, but I've seen them. And I got to say, I don't get it.
This is a thing? What is a clicker game?
So this is just a total segue. This article is not about that. But it's those games where you increasingly make money or points or whatever. And it just goes up and up and up until you have these crazy tall numbers.
It's just counting your clicks. It's literally busy work and you feel accomplished because the score tells you how many times you've clicked. It's insane. I don't understand them.
Oh, it's just a dopamine response.
Pretty much. Yeah.
But then you can unlock upgrades that automates it. And then you can kind of sit back. There's a total variety of genres. But
yeah, it's crazy.
Anyways, so Russia is trying to play an incremental clicker game with Google because they have fined Google $20 undecillion.
I understand the segue now. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. So to be clear, that is $20 followed by 33 zeros after 20. So that much money. So this article comes to us from CNN. It's titled Russia Fines Google 20 That Many Zeros. So this is because they refuse to pay fines that are now accruing for blocking pro-Russian channels on YouTube. The virtually unpronounceable penalty amounts to $20 trillion, which dwarfs the size of the global economy, which is, according to International Monetary Fund figures, about $110 trillion in world gross domestic product.
Not even close. Like, orders of magnitude bigger than the world global economy.
But all of it is made up anyway, so why not go for the moon, right?
Yeah.
I see him saying this, like, while he's saying, like, he's suing them, and he's putting his pinky in his mouth.
Yeah.
So to be fair, Google parent Alphabet does have a market value of around $2 trillion, which is kind of crazy. Like Google/Alphabet alone is like almost 1% of the entire global economy. So the Russian state media TASS reported this week that a Russian court had earlier ordered Google to restore the YouTube channels, several of which have been blocked since 2022, or else face mounting charges with penalties doubling every week. Asked about the lawsuit during a call with reporters on Thursday, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov admitted that he can't even pronounce this figure right, but said that the eye-watering sum was filled with symbolism. Google should not be restricting the actions of our broadcasters on its platform, he said.
Why not?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
They know how to get around it. You just shoot 10 mil to Tenet Media and boom.
Yeah, literally. I mean, just go back to the people you already have in your pocket, Russia. Like, there's so many of them here. Anyways, so CNN has contacted Google for comment. In quarterly earnings published this week, the company referred to ongoing legal matters relating to its business in Russia. And Google said, civil judgments that include compounding penalties have been imposed upon us in connection with disputes regarding the termination of accounts, including those of sanctioned parties. We do not believe these ongoing legal matters will have a material adverse effect on earnings. So following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Google curtailed operations in the country but stopped short of pulling out altogether, in contrast with several other American tech companies. Many of its services, including Search and YouTube, continue to be available in the country. Months after the invasion, Google's Russia subsidiary filed for bankruptcy and paused most of its commercial operations after the government seized control of its bank accounts. So it's kind of like, what did you expect? Like, Google, there's no like First Amendment law that is international and applies to businesses. Like, that's just not how it works.
Applied to private businesses.
Yeah. Right.
And but like, they've been working very hard to exploit the fragile fault lines in our First Amendment faith, right? So that if the principle of anybody who wants to say something should say something, they're going to take that to its most negative intended effect. That's worked very well for them over the past few years.
Here's the thing, though. Classically, if you don't like a fine that you've been given, what you do is you pay it in pennies, right? So all Google has to do is get more copper than the entire universe, dump it all on Russia and be like, I did what you said.
Yeah, it's not a bomb, it's a payment.
Next link.
Next link.
Well, speaking of money, I got a pretty short one for you here. Everybody check your piggy banks. This is from the Associated Press. Rare dime bought by Ohio farm family and hidden for decade fetches $500,000 at auction.
Oh, my.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
The coin, which was struck by the U.S. Mint in San Francisco in 1975, depicts President FDR and is one of only two known to exist without its distinctive S mint mark. Three sisters from Ohio inherited the dime after the death of their brother, who had kept it in a bank vault for more than 40 years. The coin sold for $506,250.
Yeah, but you do have to reduce that dollar amount by the 10 cents of the coin. So I'm just saying, and 90 cents.
The mint in San Francisco made more than 2.8 million special uncirculated proof sets in 1975 that featured six coins and were sold for $7. But what makes the two coins so special is that collectors a few years back discovered that two dimes from the entire set were missing the mint mark. Russell said the sisters from Ohio, who wanted to remain anonymous, told him that they inherited one of the two dimes, but that their brother and mother bought the first error coin discovered in 1978 for $18,000, which would amount to roughly $90,000 today.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, they saw it as an investment. They knew what they were doing.
Yep. So I hope the kids go out there and spend it well and buy them some jet skis.
No.
Or a boat.
No.
A boat.
That's those are useful on a farm, right?
In Ohio.
Yeah, exactly.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, again, in the category of news you like to hear, this is a short and sweet one from CNN called Iceland Embraced a Shorter Work Week. Here's how it turned out. Spoiler alert, it turned out well.
Of course.
Yay!
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, they're kind of going through like, well, how do we know that it turned out well? And of course, with any kind of an economics question, it takes a lot of years to figure out, did it really work well or not?
We need data.
So initially, the first two trials were between 2015 and 2019, where public sector employees only, so government workers, were reduced to 35 to 36 hours per week, but with no reduction in pay. Those trials just involved 2,500 people, which is more than 1% of Iceland's working population, but again, not that many people. And they found, in fact, that productivity stayed the same or improved, while workers' well-being increased, quote, dramatically on a range of measures from perceived stress and burnout to health and work-life balance. And once they released the results of that little government study, the trade unions jumped in and said, cool, we want this too, and negotiated reductions in working hours for tens of thousands of their members across the country.
Oh, union power.
Yeah. So having done that, they're now like, okay, did that work? Because between 2020 and 2022, 51% of all workers in Iceland had accepted the offer of shorter working hours. And two different think tanks have looked at those numbers. They say, first of all, that 51%, probably a little low. We think more people have done it as of today. Mm-hmm. And in 2023, Iceland's economy expanded by 5%, which is a growth rate second only to that of Malta among rich European economies, according to the International Monetary Fund's latest World Economic Outlook, which was published earlier this week. That is, they note, much higher than the country's average growth rate of almost 2%. in the decade between 2006 and 2015. Gosh. And it does make sense that they're like, listen, we really got to kind of exclude 2020 and its aftermath because that messed up everybody's economies. Right. But they're like, listen, we're up now a little past that. Mm-hmm. And our economy is growing faster than it ever has before.
Yeah.
So it feels like this actually really did have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much it. They're basically saying, now, hold on a second, because we do expect growth to decline a little in the years after this. Partly because there's further softening domestic demand and decelerating growth in tourism spending. They think fewer people are visiting Iceland, which I don't know why. It's going to get warmer and more beautiful, y'all. Iceland's a place to go. But they do also have a classically low unemployment rate. And they're like, if that goes up, then obviously the economy is going to follow a little bit. Economics is complicated, as we saw in our last article, where a dime was worth a stupid amount of money.
Exactly. But time is money, and giving more back to workers is a win for everybody.
Yeah. Well, and they're basically, they've done some of these studies in the US and Ireland, too. And basically, every time they do it, they're like, yeah, they're doing the same amount of work they were before. They're just screwing off less. Because this is the amount of work someone is capable of doing without burning themselves out. And they can do it faster if you let them. Just let them go home.
We've effectively hit the productivity threshold. It's now up to companies to figure that the F out.
Right. Well, and, you know, I just like to say we're officially not going to a four-day work week because we work way less than that for this. But... All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include... Math's bunk bed conjecture has been debunked. Researchers tortured robots to test the limits of human empathy. And that's not blood, it's a fungus oozing excess juice. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on daminteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/daminteresting week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.